This audio was recorded at the 2010 Dublin Anarchist Book Fair. This session is Revolutionary Experiments in Ireland, 1917 to 1923, given by Conor Costick, who is the author of Revolution in Ireland's Popular Militancy, 1917 to 1923. You'll find more about the book fair and more audio at www.wsm.ie.
Okay, thanks everybody for coming along. This is Conor Costick, author of Revolution in Ireland, and he'll be talking about the working class revolutions in the between 1917 and 1923. So,
thanks. Yeah, it's well. First of all, I want to thank the WSM for providing the platform to talk about this. I always enjoy talking about it because I think it's absolutely fascinating the kind of material that we're not normally familiar with. From that period, 1917 to 23, it's the period when Ireland, 26 counties at least, escaped the empire. And if you think to the conventional narrative of what happened in that period, it goes something like this, that Britain was determined to hold on to the colony, that the efforts of Sinn Féin in organising the First Dáil and in politically mobilising the Irish population, combined with the military efforts of the IRA, were sufficient to force Britain to come to the negotiating table with a treaty then that represented a compromise on both sides, an unsatisfactory one that split the nationalist movement. And that's the conventional narrative, but my concern, I moved to Ireland 20 years ago and had a big interest in that period and a question in my mind as to how did Britain really be forced? How was Britain forced from the negotiating table? Is it sufficient to look at the explanation about political activity of Sinn Féin, military activity of IRA? I was dissatisfied from one simple statistic that only 400 odd British soldiers were killed in this entire period. Now, that can hardly have had the empire trembling. I mean, this is an empire that's cast millions of lives into the trenches. It's an empire that has up to 100,000 troops available for the suppression of Ireland. What budged them? What caused them to shift? And having read there's a book on the Limerick Soviet by Liam Cahill, and there's D.R. O'Connor Lycett's pamphlet on it, and having read those, I realised there was an alternative story to tell and did the research into that. And quite a large part of what I'm going to say today is I'm simply going to read to you some of the material I found. Because it really is eye-opening and very, very exciting if you're someone whose sympathies lie with the working class movement, because it comes as a wonderful surprise to find that Ireland has the most militant and radical examples of workers taking control of their lives, of their communities and their cities as part of the process of trying to defeat the Black and Tans and the British Army and British administration here in Ireland. And we just, until recently really, just haven't had this material presented to us, so I'm going to mainly concentrate on that. And the first signs that the Irish working class were going to play a very important part in the struggle for independence came towards the end of the Great War, when Britain threatened conscription on Ireland. A massive danger of conscription. Britain was desperate because Germany had launched its final throw of the dice, a big offensive in March 1918, and the British general saw no reason why Ireland should be exempt from conscription when the rest of the UK had conscription. So it was a genuine threat, and the conscription law was indeed passed. It was going to be implemented, but it was stopped in its tracks. And what stopped it was a general strike. And there was an enormous general strike against conscription. It's the first time sign of major radicalism in the working class. It wasn't a completely independent action by the working class. The Irish middle class, of course, were also against conscription, and they supported the strike as well. So there was a sort of pan-nationalist alliance to call the strike. Workers didn't really have to defy their employers, but nevertheless, it was a very, very impressive turnout. Completely solid. Nothing moved for that day. And it rather stunned the Irish Times, whose report on the day quite rightly observed, April 23rd will be chiefly remembered as the day on which Irish Labour realised its strength. Because what the general strike did was wake up the working class movement to its power. I mean, it really, when you read the Labour papers especially, they're delighted with the response, stunned themselves by how effective it was, and this very quickly led to workers begin to push an agenda that's slightly different to that of Sinn Féin. Of course, the Irish working class was totally in favour of independence, brought up in traditions such as that of James Connolly, it can't be otherwise, and expecting that their living standards would rise as a result of escaping the empire. Of course, they're for independence, but the type of independence and the method of achieving it was very different to that being promoted by Sinn Féin. And I'm going to talk mainly about affairs in the South, but before I do, the next really big turning point in this period for Irish Labour occurs in the North, in Belfast. And it's got very important consequences, what happens in January 1919 there, for the eventual partition of Ireland. Because it was by far the case then, from the case, that the Protestant workers of the North were necessarily alienated from the idea of a Republican or independent Ireland. That was still up for grabs, that question, because they were very dissatisfied with their experiences under the Empire. The Protestant engineers of Northern Ireland during the wartime had seen their living standards absolutely eroded as Britain drove them harder and harder to get the arms production they needed, ship production, to win the war. And the life of a skilled engineer in Belfast during the war years was one that had worsened, in particular the length of the working week. So now with the war over, they wanted a shorter working week. And they struck for the shorter working week, for 44 hours they wanted. And they struck in a very hard and militant fashion. And Catholic and Protestant workers stood together to bring Belfast to a halt. And so powerful was their action that they very quickly found, and this is one of the themes of the period, is that having gone on general strike, they very quickly found they had to take responsibility for the distribution of power, for the distribution of food supplies, for the movement of transport around the city. That all had to happen by decree of the strike committee. And as a result, you find the authorities absolutely paralysed in the north and a feeling that the workers are in charge. And this is a telegram from the Belfast authorities to the British cabinet at the time. The working men have formed a Soviet committee. They didn't actually call themselves a Soviet. That word was about to appear in Irish politics, but not. This isn't actually the first instance of it. But the authorities saw them as a Soviet. He says, the working men have formed a Soviet committee, and this committee has received 47 applications from small traders for permission to use light. In other words, the authorities are annoyed that it's the strike committee to whom people are applying now for permission to have energy and to move transport. And the sectarian atmosphere of Belfast was extremely diminished by this action. The majority of strikers would have had a Protestant background, but their strike committee was mixed Protestant Catholic, and indeed their main spokesperson, a man called Charles Mackay, was a Catholic. And he was at great efforts to emphasise that religion was not a factor in their strike and that it brought everyone together. And indeed, the unionist reports reflect the fact that they were reeling and from the loss of influence over people that they thought they previously had dominated. Unfortunately, the strike ends in something of a defeat. I mean, they do get 47 hours, which is a reduction of the working week, but it's felt as if it's a big betrayal. And as a result, some of that spirit of unity does decline in the aftermath, but not immediately. And we can measure just how strong the solidarity between Catholic and Protestant was, because there was an election in 1920, local elections, where PR was used, which is unusual for Ireland, and a man called Sam Kyle, who advocated home rule for Ireland, independence for Ireland, he stood in the Shankill, strong unionist constituency, and he topped the poll. The working class in 1920 were interested in the idea of a united Ireland, but the united Ireland that would appeal to Protestant workers could not be a conservative Catholic Sinn Féin one. It had to be one that offered pensions, shorter working week, high living standards for workers, and that's why this man topped the poll, because that's what he was advocating. Sam Carr was a socialist, and the kind of home rule that he was offering was that of James Connolly. That movement is the biggest reason, that united movement of workers is the biggest reason why we have the shipyard pogroms of 1921, which were designed to smash the influence of the left, and they not only drove Catholics out of the shipyards, but they also crushed the ILP, the Independent Labour Party, burning down their headquarters. And they were able to do so because of the big influx of returned soldiers after the war and the massive recession in 1921 that created a lot of joblessness and insecurity and undermined the strength of unity. But I point to that example because if events had happened differently in the South, I do believe it would have been possible to, at the very least, have emerged with a very strong left in Northern Ireland that was uniting Protestant and Catholic. But let's turn to the radicalism of the South then. And I hope you've all at least heard of the Limerick Soviet, because that was truly one of the great blows against the British Empire, and almost it had the authorities in operating in Ireland teetering on the brink of a massive defeat. What happens is that the British General Griffin, responsible for the area, introduces a military pass. Every time you enter the city of Limerick, every time you cross a bridge, you have to display your pass. And this is deeply resented by everybody, middle class, working class alike. And feelings in Limerick are exacerbated when Robert Byrne, an IRA commander, was shot while trying to escape. It's popularly believed that he's been assassinated. The actual case is a bit more ambiguous because he could have unfortunately been hit by his own side. But the fact that he died in an escape attempt was cast against the British administration, and it led to such an absurd feeling that the Limerick Trades Council took a historic decision and declared themselves a Soviet, and that the town was on strike. And what did they mean by the Soviet? They meant that they were taking charge of the city. And they take charge, they did. They took charge of, energy again, of fuels, and of transport. And the immediate response was a scare from the authorities saying, people will starve because of the lack of food production if this Soviet continues. And the Soviet responded to that scare with a very daring move. They expropriated the 6,000 tons of grain that were in port at the time from a Canadian grain ship, and they made sure that the food was distributed that way. They also had a negotiation with the bakers and bakers and apprentices and so on, and they came to an agreement that for a few hours every day the bakers would work for free to make sure that there was no food crisis. And they also then went into negotiations with the farmers. The farmers were a bit less sympathetic to the Soviets, and there was a few instances of run-ins with farmers attempting to sell their goods, take advantage of the situation to sell food at high prices. But the Soviet pasted around the town what price food was to be sold for, and those were the prices that were accepted. And anyone who disobeyed that found that their carts were overturned and they were driven out. So very quickly the farmers came to terms with it. And the fact that all the creamery workers were out on strike meant that there was an abundance of milk. So in fact the workers of Limerick never ate as well as when the Soviet ran the city. Far from starving, they actually had an abundance of cheap food at their disposal. The next crisis that the Soviet faced was that of the media. There's an enormous media presence in Limerick. Coincidentally, there was an effort to have the first transatlantic flight going on with a big prize as a reward, and the only flight going from Europe to America, rather than the other way around, was leaving out of Limerick. So a lot of the world's media were there. And the media initially took a rather scoffing tone against the Soviets, some of them downright hostile, others rather sarcastic about the workers' efforts. And so the Soviet met the media representatives and told them that they would either write favourable reports about, an honest report about what was happening in Limerick, or the hotels that they were living in would be shut down, they would have no supplies to those hotels. And very quickly the media changed their tune, and were... But just to make sure, the Soviet then took its own decision of producing its own newspaper. So they controlled information through running their own newspaper. And probably most impressive of all, and you can still see these in the museum there, when currency ran out, because the banks, of course, are closed and the workers aren't getting any income, the Limerick Soviet took the incredible initiative of printing its own money. And these scripts, which you can still see, 10 shillings produced by the authority of the Soviet, these scripts were accepted as valid in all the regional shops because it had the backing, not only of the political sympathy, but it also had the backing of the unions behind them, the value of the money. And they had control over all these food supplies. So funnily enough, the tactic of trying to intimidate them with the questions of food very much backfired against the authorities. So for 2 weeks, Limerick was uncontestedly in the hands of the Soviet. And the question is, why didn't it win? I mean, this is such a powerful example of workers' control over a city. What happened? Tragically for the Limerick workers, they were outmaneuvered by a rising Labour bureaucracy. The rank and file of the railway workers had approached Limerick strikers and said, we will declare a national strike, just give us the go-ahead and tell us to do so. In a panic, the national leaders of the Labour movement rushed head that off, because it had it spread, I think that the first of all, the military passes would have been abolished, and secondly, there would have been very severe repercussions, I think, for the British administration generally, because this example of a Soviet would have been very dangerous for them. But the Labour leaders at the time were just emerging as the kind of Labour... I mean, everyone in this room is familiar with the modern trade union official who's on a massive salary, is very detached from the rank and file. That dichotomy between the rank and file and the trade union bureaucracy was emerging in this period we're talking about. It was hard to see it at the time, because the very people who were heading the unions had been colleagues of James Connolly, had been radicals in their youth, but they had found themselves in charge of unions that had grown massively, with a massive influx of members. They had new buildings, they had new revenue, they had new political clout dealing with the authorities and dealing with the nationalists. They didn't want to jeopardise this with radical action that might go even further and exclude them in favour of more militant figures. And therefore, although they spoke with the most left-wing language you can imagine, I mean, if you look at the Labour papers of that period, they're incredible. I mean, they're all about what's happening in Russia, what's happening in Italy, the power of Soviets is great. But when it came to delivering any action, that's where they were experts in talking the talk, but in order to diffuse people's expectations. The naivety of the Limerick strikers, their lack of experience, to be honest, anyone in Ireland would not have really seen through these characters very quickly, because they were the right-hand people around Connolly and Larkin. If Larkin had been in Ireland and if Connolly had been alive, okay, maybe you would have had a somewhat different scenario, because they'd have seen from the inside what was really happening. But the Limerick Soviet was outmanoeuvred. The strike leaders at Limerick told the journalists there's going to be a general strike called, and the Labour leaders are moving to Limerick to make it their headquarters. And that's what did happen, but they carefully took their time about it. William O'Brien, Tom Johnson, they dragged their feet. When they finally got to Limerick, in the hope the things would begin to peter out, they announced their plan, and their plan, which was supposedly to have a general strike, turned into, instead they were going to rehouse everybody. The 40,000 inhabitants of Limerick were going to stay with workers who lived outside Limerick, and that way you wouldn't have to show your pass anymore. They were going to evacuate the city. And this is a farcical idea. It very much demoralised the strikers and their expectations that things were going to escalate. Very much demoralised them. And at this point, as well, they made a mistake in the Soviet, in that they made their first capitulation to the Irish capitalist class, because the big owners of the coal supplies refused the Soviet coal. And rather than expropriate that coal, they decided not to do that, but then that led to all sorts of problems in terms of running the city, and their authority began to wane. And as soon as it began to wane, the middle class moved against the Soviet through the Chamber of Commerce. They were very frightened. They may have hated the passes, but they hated the Soviet even more. And they retreated from... they put the boot in to the Soviets as quickly as they could, and they came up with a deal with the British general where the workers would have to have passes, but they wouldn't have to show them all the time. And the problem now is that the employers are issuing the passes, so it very much favours the Irish employers, the final solution. So Limerick, I'm afraid, was a defeat in the end, despite the tremendous abilities that the people had shown in organising the strike. But it wasn't the end of militancy, far from it. Outside of Limerick, Limerick itself, to be honest, went down in terms of activity thereafter. But outside of Limerick, the high point was yet to come. And that occurred the following year, in the spring of the following year. Britain had been throwing the black and tans into the battle and had been rounding up a lot of radicals simply on the basis of interning them without trial, sticking them in Mountjoy prison. And there were a lot of socialists, a lot of left-wing activists in jail, and they decided to go on strike, hunger strike. So they began it, 30 of them, then 60, then 90 on hunger strike. The word of the strike spread to their colleagues outside of the prison. And again, an irresistible surge of militancy rose up and obliged the Labour leaders to call a general strike for the release of these hunger strikers. And it's this general strike that marks the high point of the Soviet experience in Ireland. And I'm going to read you several of the examples of what happened. Basically, all over the country, from the smallest towns to the biggest, workers went on general strike and set up Soviets to run the strike, what they called Soviets. They didn't actually know what a Soviet looked like from the Russian experience, but they'd read about them, and they appropriated the name because it sounded like the sort of thing they wanted. So this is from Waterford, according to the Manchester Guardian. The city was taken over by a Soviet commissar and three associates. The Sinn Féin mayor abdicated, and the Soviet issued orders to the population, which all had to obey. For 2 days, until a telegram arrived announcing the release of the hunger strikers, the city was in the hands of these men. From Bagnallstown, I was reading this in the library. It's just a little handwritten report on lined paper. And he talks about what they did in the strike. He's writing back to his trade union headquarters. And then he has this most amazing PS that made me want to sort of laugh aloud, but wasn't appropriate in this quiet library. But PS, on the second day of the strike, we held a public meeting on the market square and proclaimed the establishment of a provisional Soviet government to police this town, to keep order, ration out food supplies, etc. Now, you know, how many people knew that Bagnallstown had the Soviets? I mean, okay, some of you do, because some of you I know are experts in Labour history, but it came as a big surprise to me. And you go through the list: Castletown, Roach, Kells, Tralee, Nace, Maybrough. We've got a good description of what these look like from Kilmallock, East Limerick, from a journalist. He said, a visit to the town hall, commandeered for the purpose of issuing permits, and one was struck by the absolute recognition of the Soviet system. At one table sat a school teacher dispensing bread permits, at another a trade union official controlling the flour supply, at a third a railwayman controlling coal, and a fourth a creamery clerk distributing butter tickets, all working smoothly. It was quite an ordinary thing to observe a motor going through the markets with the sign commandeered by the Kilmallock Strike Committee. And altogether one felt sorry, if it wasn't for the wonderful achievement, that things had not carried on thus for a few more days. And what he's referring to there is the fact that faced with this militancy, Britain caved in. And an astonishing retreat that caused massive disgust amongst imperial circles. But they released all the hunger strikers. And at first they made them said, you can go if you sign a pledge saying you'll come back for trial when your trial starts. The hunger strikers said, no, we're not signing that. And they let them go anyway. the alternative was far worse for the authorities, which was an extension of this militancy and this control over Irish society. And this fed through to another wave of strikes. And I think a very important action as well, sparked by the British dockers' refusal to load arms to British Army going to Russia, the Irish dockers similarly started refusing to unload supplies for the British Army in Ireland, and this spread to the railway workers refusing to move British troops. And there's in The Wind That Shakes the Bar, this is well depicted cinematically, but it was the case that a soldier, an officer, would march up to the head of the train, point the gun at the driver and say, you will move this train. And the driver would say, no, I won't. And that moment tells us a lot about the state of the struggle in Ireland. Why couldn't the officer just simply shoot the rail worker? If it was a matter of a guerrilla war, I think the officer, if it was a simple guerrilla war situation, I think the officer could have shot the rail worker. The reason why the officer then had to turn and, to his shame, order all the troops to disembark because the train wasn't leaving is because the rail worker, if he'd have been shot, there would have been a general strike, no question. It would have been a repetition of these kind of events. And the other question you ask yourself, how does a rail worker have the confidence to stand in front of a loaded gun in a period where the Black and Tans have killed a lot of young men out of hand and tell this officer no? Where did he get that courage from? Obviously, individually, these were courageous people, but it's a social courage. It comes from knowing that you're part of a mass movement and that at your back are hundreds of thousands of other people who will make a stand with you. I think I don't know about yourselves, I would find it very hard to look at a loaded gun and say no. But I would say no, I think, if I was in the spirit of these times. And so, I think that it's written out of history, but I think it's the essential backbone behind the resistance to the British Empire. And without it, repression might well have been much more effective. With it, the ability of the British Army to operate in Ireland is massively undermined. So I just conclude so that we've got time for questions and answers by saying that the treaty, when it comes in, I think should be seen as something of a class war, because the treaty was very much about the Irish elite and Irish capitalist class who have lost control over events getting back into the saddle. And the main party supporting the treaty are those of the big business, the big railway owners, the big brewers. The media, they're rushing in to, and the church back the treaty, and they're backing it in the name of law and order. They want to get a stable, calm Ireland back in control. And it's interesting, I read through the minutes of the provisional government, the Free State government. More than half those minutes are occupied not with anti-treaty battles and the war, but with putting down a spate of Soviets that sprang up again in 1922, especially the Creamy Soviets and the brewery, bakery and so on. I don't have time to talk about them, but the Civil War was not just about crushing Republicans, it was also about crushing the left. And the left, whenever the Free State troops got into a town, they ended these Soviets by military means. By way of a conclusion, first of all, the working class deserve to be recognised as being the backbone of the successful resistance to the British Empire. And secondly, I believe that there was a lot more to be gained from the working class movement, not least in the emergence of massive radical parties out of this period, but the left was skillfully outmanoeuvred by a rising trade union bureaucracy who instead reaped the rewards.
Okay, Conor, thanks very much. Now we'll take some questions, and we'll maybe take them one by one and let you answer them in turn.
Just on your last point there about the... I agree absolutely that the Free State government were a horrible right-wing lot, but do you feel that maybe if the treaty could have been accepted, that there might have been more of a working-class influence on the Free State government, if the stepping stone procedure had been adopted?
Well, it was. I mean, the Free State won, so in short... It gave nothing to workers. Larkin's position was good, I felt. When I read about Larkin, Larkin unfortunately didn't get back to Ireland until 23, and when he did, he had to take a position on the Civil War, and he said, we're against the treaty, but by civil means rather than military, because the military means, first of all, it wasn't working, and secondly, it was ghettoising the opposition to the treaty. So he wanted to encourage social disobedience to the treaty, and the treaty was awful for the working class movement. I mean, Kevin O'Higgins is a really vicious right-wing minister, and the first thing they did was break a strike by shooting at the strikers, a public servant strike, to make it clear who was boss. Then they took away the right to have meetings in O'Connell Street, driving their armoured cars up and down when Cunamán tried to hold meetings there. So a reactionary state, and I think the Larkin position is the one I would have personally followed, which is, I'm against the treaty, but I'm not going to take up arms against it, it's not going to work. I'm going to encourage civil disobedience to it.
Okay, Alex?
The founding of the ITGWU and kind of the origins that really kind of emerged out of the syndicalist movement in America, the Lion, or the Neon, I can't pronounce his name, and Connolly certainly kind of took that on. And would you not say that what happened after Connolly died and the way that William O'Brien was very much seen as his successor, I think even there's when Connolly was captured, he says, I hope they didn't get O'Brien or something like that, or preserve him for the future. Do you think that O'Brien saw that thing, the idea of building one big union, as did that consume him and in the sense that become his main drive and his only drive, and that he wasn't interested in necessarily building a revolutionary syndicalist socialist kind of society, but just to build the union, and that became his, because he's been described in his biography as kind of he wanted to make the ITGU like a business,
yeah,
some type, to make it official, and he brought in organized the offices, running secretaries and everything, and it became almost like a business for him. So really any type of for him it wasn't so much that he became a kind of reformist, or whatever you want to call it, but that his only aim was to build the union which Connor created, you know, or perhaps, or would you disagree and say that maybe he was kind of, he lost his after Connolly was killed, he just lost his revolutionary zeal, or if he ever had it?
I think it's very hard for anybody, if you're caught up in a social circle, and that social circle suddenly lifting, you're all getting richer, you're all getting more political influence, it's very hard to say, yeah, but this is coming at a price we shouldn't pay, which is that we're becoming conservative figures. Only someone like who's so deeply imbued in the traditions of militancy like Larkin resisted the growth of trade union bureaucracy. And I think O'Brien became a cynic. So I do disagree with you in the sense that I think he quite cynically knew what he was doing when he used left-wing language for conservative decisions. I don't think it's that he picked one aspect of the ideology and then focused on that and that turned him conservative. I think he knew exactly what he was doing. And there's a book downstairs, actually, just €5, Force the Banners Go, his reminiscences. And you get some amazing reminiscences, but they're also rather cynical ones. And here's a more candid speech by him to this trade union, to the ITG conference in 1918. Here is our opportunity when we're growing and expanding. Let's get fully equipped offices. Let's man them with the best men and women money and love can buy. Let our officials be highly skilled, well-trained, and where necessary, experts and specialists. Let's adopt all the best, most up-to-date methods of conducting a business. For the conduct of our movement is to a certain degree a great business, and we must manage it on big business lines. So, that, you know, he's in charge of this tremendous growth, tremendous resources. That's what he wants to consolidate. And this radicalism I talked about is actually a threat, partly because he might actually end up dead. I mean, the Black and Towns weren't very discriminatory between Labour leaders, Labour rank and file. They did shoot a lot of trade unions. Yeah, he was. He had to go on hunger strike himself. So, I mean, it's a precarious thing to get involved in the struggle. But partly, I think, to consolidate this in the way you just said.
So, you had that question?
Yourself?
Yeah.
It's probably going off the subject a little bit, but just talking earlier on. And I always wondered if Collins had lived. Did you see in any of your research any indication at all that there was a possible military
dictatorship on the cards? Yeah, Collins, very interesting figure to me. Fascinating figure because he's complex. He's not. There isn't a cut and dried analysis. The analysis I follow most came from D.R. O'Connor Lycett's argument that he was a Bonapartist figure. And this is a technical argument, that comparing him to the nephew of Napoleon Bonaparte, who in France in the 1850s, because the capitalist class and the working class were sort of stymied in bitter conflict, this Bonaparte figure, he was in charge of the army, was able to get into power and balance the two sides off. And I think that works as an analogy for Collins. Personally, Collins was so sympathetic to the working class. Personally, not politically, but he, for example, in the War of Independence, he built his intelligence network essentially out of working class support. And it's not appreciated how much the Collins network relied on postal workers, secretaries, and so on. And all that material has only recently come to light. The GPO was stitched up by Collins, but it was an ordinary post office worker. What happened was a policeman, rather stupidly, signed off in code, message received and understood. And the smart the telegraphist figured out that's what he'd done. So they broke the code. They figured, and so every telegram that went to the GPO found its way to Collins, thanks to the rank and file. And Collins, I remember once reading that one of the things I found was someone saying that he was taken to a pub for a meeting, but there was a strike on. They had to cross the picket line to go in. And Collins said, we shouldn't do this. So on a personal level, he understood and was connected to the working class movement in that sense. But when he took the decision to sign the treaty, he did so as a very practical, pragmatic military figure. And he aligned himself with Griffiths, and he turned his back on... He did what was necessary to implement that treaty, including firing on his old comrades in the forecourt, but also in crushing the working class movement to make the thing. So I don't think he was so influential because he's balancing between, on the one hand, the left and the working class movement, on the other hand, the real far right, the genuine sort of white guard of the situation. There was an organisation called the Farmers' Freedom Force, organised to represent rich farmers, and their policy was to crush the ITGWU, and they said in their paper there are not enough lampposts to hang the organisers of the ITGWU. So you've got these kind of characters, you've got the Kevin O'Higgins kind of character, they're way to the right of Collins. And he is, to some extent, balancing off. They need him. There's no way the Free State government could deliver the sort of people Collins could deliver. Collins could at least neutralise some of the lefties, stop them being anti-treaty, and bring with him a lot of, on the argument, this is the best we can get, stepping stone argument. He brought with him a lot of people who naturally should have gravitated against the treaty. And so they needed him. But the people who benefited from his death, most of all, were the more conservative figures. And therefore, I have no time for the theory that De Valera conspired to have Collins killed. I don't believe it for an instant, because the centre of gravity in Irish politics then swings to the right. It doesn't help De Valera one bit.
Okay, Lawrence?
Can you just maybe take us through the process that got the democratic programme in the first stall? Because that's something we haven't mentioned yet.
Yeah, well, I think there's too much read into that. On the one hand, the Democratic Programme is a very radical document. Frankly, today we could do with implementing some of the policies they believed in back then. On the other hand, it's a cynical exercise in winning Ireland's national status. You see, there's an international socialist conference taking place at Bern for the Second International, and the Irish Labour delegates say we could get recognised as an independent nation and seated as a separate nation if the Second International sees that the Republic is going to be a sort of left-leaning Republic. So can we have a few... So Tom Johnson for the Labour movement met with some of the Sinn Féin activists, and they drew up this democratic programme, which is left of centre, but I think it was more for consumption internationally than they actually planned to implement it. And somebody, maybe Sean Tineo Kelly, but I could be wrong about that, said that the socialist phrases in it made him sick and he intended to cross them out. But it's Richard Mulcahy, isn't it, who just... Richard Mulcahy from the Nationalists works with Tom Johnson. They draw this up, but I don't believe they ever would have set out to implement it. That's my feeling on it. I don't know how you feel about it. It's still something we would fight for, some of the demands in it today.
Well, I think that was largely a concession to Labour.
Yeah.
Because in the period just after the rising, the Labour unions were so strong and Sinn Féin needed their support.
Yeah. No, I'd accept that as well. Yeah, definitely.
Collins was a reactionary, as they on the task, and he says that many times to read it.
Yeah.
You know, and he even condemns the democratic programme, but again, it's very pragmatic. So he says, look, that's what we need to get this thing going. We go there.
Yeah.
It's a lot of sort of communist sort of nonsense,
basically. Yeah, that's how the nationalists thought.
Nevertheless, they wouldn't have conceded it if they didn't feel pressure to concede it.
Sorry, the man with the shaved head just there.
Yeah, I just wanted to say, something that just seems strange from what you're talking about is the fact that the Labour movement was strongest under colonialism and afterwards became less significant, and then perhaps nationalism was a more significant radical political force in the rest of the 20th century. And what you'd expect is the opposite. You'd expect nationalism to be very strong under a colonial regime as an expression of radical politics, and Labour politics to be very strong under an independent, more or less independent.
Yeah, that would be I would have thought that dynamic would be the typical one, but what we've got here is a defeated working class movement coming in. The Free State crushes the working class movement, and I think that marks the generation who've been saying, like, we'll wait till we've solved the national question, then we'll push class. By the time it came to push class, they were shattered. So that, I would have expected Labour to come into its own because there's no longer such a focus on the national question. Although there's still the North, of course, but it didn't happen that way. And I think simply because that generation had given their best, motivated by the desire to both beat Britain and improve their living standards, they'd really fought hard. They'd gone on general strike, they'd marched, they'd protested, and then they'd lost. They'd got this Free State. And I think that disillusionment that set in meant that, the pattern that you suggest should have happened didn't. I think it was a big demoralisation set in and didn't really pick up again until the 30s.
Okay, now with
that. Kind of feed into my question about why do you think the historiography of the period is, from a left point of view, being so sidelined? I think you got an answer with disillusionment.
Yeah.
Post-independence, but you left Republic of Attica, the Padre O'Donnell, who's, wrote with the memoirs in a period, but again, it seems to be kind of overwhelmed by the mainstream narrative of what happened, like in the obsession with 1916. But it's right what the last speaker said, that, I mean, living standards are going to be dropped.
Yeah, oh, it is.
Independence, yeah. So, do you think that class view of history would have been stronger? Why do you think the historiography is so weak then?
During these radical years, living standards rose massively, shorter working week, the Free State lowered wages across the board, and the demoralisation settled. Yeah, on the historiography, I think in modern terms it's because not so many revolutionary socialists, find their way into academia and the time to root through the archives and so on. I mean, some do. It's not a conspiracy. There's nothing, Courtney is the best publisher, there's fair play to them. But most historians in the bigger colleges tend to come from Fianna Fáil or Fianna Gael traditions, so they're not really interested. It's not that they're hostile. They're not going to root around and change the archives. The people who ought to have written the history were the far left, which would have been the revolutionary syndicalists and the small communist party, but they got involved in really bitter, narrow sectarian infighting, because it's very hard to survive in the 20s. And go forward. And so they didn't produce any good historians, I don't think. But then the 30s, you do see a revival of left-wing historiography around the Republican Congress movement. You've got some very talented historians, and they helped me understand what was happening in this period. They didn't produce books, and they only produced partial pictures, but they did produce pamphlets on this, that, and the other aspect. So from once you get a revival of the left in Ireland, you get a revival of left-wing historiography.
The man at the very back there.
Hi, thanks for the evaluation of the impact of the working class on the early part of this last century. And I missed the beginning of your talk, so I don't know if you covered some of these areas, and if you did, please forgive me. But I don't know if you covered, for instance, the influence of, you talked about union bureaucracies. Well, the big union bureaucracies were essentially British-based at that time. And from what I can see of Larkin's struggles, certainly the British-based unions worked against him. The British TUC worked against him. Worked against him in Belfast. The mediator they sent in to mediate the struggle there, and allegedly to help them, actually ended up meeting with the employers without Larkin and without strike leaders in Shafton. And the split with the ITGW is well known. And how that came about, how they ended up putting the law in for using union funds to pay strikers. So that's one aspect, I think. And then the other aspect as well that's very important and is sometimes, I think, underestimated by people who don't want to overplay the effect of loyalism for fear of falling into the nationalist camp. But loyalism was a very strong influence as well in the north, and it also played its part. Sectarianism came much more at that time from the unionist camp than it did from the nationalist camp, although certainly there was sectarianism on the nationalist camp as well. Then I think another aspect as well is that the huge Protestant landowning class that was still left in Ireland at that time, came as a shock to a lot of us to learn that, for instance, up to the 50th anniversary of the Rising, that the land the GPO stood on was still being paid to foreign landowners. And some of those people were still very influential in business circles and in power circles in Ireland at the time that you're talking about. My own father told me, for instance, about adverse for Clerius and other places that said no Catholic workers need apply. The two whiskey firms in Dublin were known as the Protestant whiskey and the Catholic whiskey. And then also the whole influence of the intelligentsia. Many of those had been to the forefront of forming nationalist consciousness, and many of them were from Protestant background, like Yeats, for instance, and Douglas Hyde. And they became the backbone then of the conservative intelligentsia setting up this capitalist state. And finally, I wonder what weight you would give to the fact that the Irish capitalist class never really developed an independent program, an independent economic program, and was in essence what used to be called in the 60s and 70s a comprador capitalist class, foreign dependent, something like Latin America and the United States today.
Just on that lateral first, well, it's fresh in my mind. I think that it cost them the North. The North was there to be won in this period, but the Irish capitalist class in the South did not understand the counterparts in the North at all. They thought they could coerce them into a united Ireland by having an economic boycott, and the economic boycott was a catastrophe, and it just proved the opposite. It proved that the big ship owners and businessmen in Northern Ireland didn't need the South, and the Southern banking system and agricultural system didn't need it. So they hadn't done their... They weren't a sophisticated, well-organised class. They hadn't done their homework. They misunderstood the situation. So I think that is why we have a partitioned Ireland, partly. I think had they won in 1798, we'd have had a united Ireland. Because back then, there was a common interest of the capitalist class right across Ireland. Because at that stage, you hadn't got the modern industry and its ties to empire in the North. But just a couple of your other points, just briefly. I think that it's more complex, I think, the situation with regard to the trade unions. You're right that the British trade union leadership were more conservative even than the Irish. I mean, there were people who were getting knighthoods and so on. But the fact that the Irish branches were so far geographically and sort of culturally from their British trade union leaders meant that quite often it was the British-based unions performing some of the most radical actions. So the National Union Rail Workers is a good example. I mean, they were the most radical union at the time, and the whole idea of boycotting the troops, you know, the British leadership would have opposed it, but they went ahead anyway. And the TNG, on the other hand, I think the TNG bureaucracy was the most left-seeming, and it had some genuine militants in it who really did push a syndicalist agenda and with great effect, but it was also the most stifling because it was on the ground. It was here. It was able to outmaneuver. And the figures are something like the trade union movement grew from before 1918 to about 40,000 to 100,000 by 1920. This is roughly 60,000 being Irish Transport and General Worker Union members. So it's really, you know, you can't blame the failure of the Irish Revolution to have developed a more, you know, a better outcome for the left just on the British unions. Yeah, you know, I would say the TNG leadership is primarily responsible, and but absolutely true that the British trade union leaders would have tried to stifle things, but they weren't that effective at doing so. Sorry, do we have time?
Yeah.
Just on the North, I was looking into the pogroms because I was wondering how could the people who'd gone on strike together then turn against each other, and it turns out they didn't. The pogroms were organised from outside the shipyards, and insofar as they involved shipyard workers, they were apprentices and returned workers who'd been in the war. So the people who'd actually been on strike, shoulder to shoulder, didn't turn on one another. It was whipped up by the unionists, and the employers, of course, of the shipyards obviously welcomed the opportunity to drive not just Catholics out, but the left out as well. I think. I'm a bit rusty on the figures, but I think it's like 20,000 people driven out of their jobs, 7,000 of which are Protestants, left-wing Protestants. So it wasn't all Catholics by any means. But anyway, the skilled workers were pretty solid and had a certain amount of solidarity with one another, but it was the unskilled who were used against them. And to my mind, there's a pattern in 1919 right across the world that there's a recession starts, and you get pogroms in other countries. So like in Chicago, you get race riots where the unemployed are used to attack black workers and drive them out of jobs. So it was an era where the start of a recession and the fears of unemployment allowed right-wing forces to attempt to push the left by mobilising people who weren't actually in the workplace.
Okay, Alan?
Something that's puzzled me for a while is the urban-rural balance at that time. Usually you get far less radical stuff in words because there's fewer people around, fewer ideas changing hands, you know, all that sort of stuff. Yet, that period, like we saw sort of a straight wave tied in with the transport unions organisation taking its most radical forms, calling stuff Soviets, and with so many small, relatively small out of the way places like the fishing fleet in Castleconnell or the coach works in Tipperary town, and but we hear very little about Dublin. Like, I know that there was one such, if you like, radical strike, I think a clothing factory in York Street, and we know that there were 10,000 met at the Mansion House to celebrate the first anniversary of the Russian Revolution. But that's all I've ever heard of from that period. It all seems to be the bulk of it seems to be happening in North Munster, and then throughout other basically rural areas, Mona and so on. Where was Dublin in all this? Is it just that history hasn't covered it, because the transport union was organising just as much in the city?
Yeah, good question. I thought you were going to raise something else, actually. The most common objection to this book has been from people who come from who've read Hugh Gibbon and Patterson's works, and they say that never could have been a socialist revolution because it was too Catholic and too conservative on the land. And I thought you were going to bring that point up, the rule. And in fact, the evidence is the opposite. The struggle on the land was unbelievable. I mean, there was red armies formed to fight white armies. One journalist saying, this looks like the First World War. I mean, there's actual battles going on, class war going on in the Irish rural landscape. So, I don't accept the conservative landscape argument. But that is a really good question. And I don't know, for example, why did Dublin not play the role that Paris did in the French Revolution? Where were the sans-culottes for the United Irishmen, you know, in Dublin? And it's a good question for this period. I'd have to think about it, Alan. Off the top of my head, I don't think the answer is it's hidden from history. Yeah, some of it will be, but it wasn't there. The high point for Dublin, sort of like, you know, I described how there was a strike for the hunger strikers, and this led to Soviets all over Ireland and all the out-of-way places. It didn't lead to one here. And I think it's because O'Brien, Johnson, Farron, they're all here. And if Dublin Trades Council comes up with a motion to have a Soviet to run the city, they're going to head that off. And they did. 40,000 dockers led a strike of 40,000 during that hunger strike. They marched them up to the Mountjoy. And we very nearly had a Bastille Day in Ireland, because they tried to storm their Mountjoy to get to the prisoners, get them out. And what held them back was priests and Sinn Féin running down, linking arms, saying no, we mustn't, and in 24 hours the British rushed in the extra tanks and the barbed wire, and it didn't happen, but it was on the cards that something like that was going to happen there. But I suppose I reckon it's probably the answer to your question, which I'm not sure of without looking into it, is that the social weight of the more conservative Labour figures was heavier in Dublin. And the Dublin left as well was in bits because of Connolly's death had left very little behind. Whereas we had people like Dowling and McGrath operating in Munster with a free hand. So they would say to the workers, the way to win is to have a Soviet. The workers say, great, that's what we want to do. So there's no clash between the leadership being offered and the mood of the workers. In Dublin, I suspect there weren't any radical activists or capable of outmanoeuvring the O'Brienites.
Wasn't there also...
Sorry, just let people know, there's 10 minutes left, and Lawrence left to speak.
I was just wondering, wasn't there not an element also that the farm labourers on the land in terms of bringing in the farm labourers on the land in terms of when they brought in the... Was there not a bit in relation to the farm labourers on the land in terms of like the I think it's Corn Production Act they brought in, the British government brought in 1917, which kind of brought in better wages for workers, and then the kind of the forcing landowners to kind of negotiate, and also the wages movement in Dublin, which had been progressing since like 1915, which actually had brought in a bit more stability within Dublin itself, whereas in this countryside there had been no monetary regulation on kind of wages or conditions, and also like you said, the freedom to kind of organise.
So the point was, do we explain sort of the lack of rural militancy around Dublin because of the existence of these wage boards and so on?
Yeah.
Actually, what it did was those institutions changed the pattern of struggle on the land in an east-west way, but they were both very radical. In the west, it took the form of expropriating the landowners, not necessarily Protestant, but the big landowners, especially the absentee ones. They were all broken up and their land redistributed, and you had rural Soviets to do that. But in the East, they didn't try and break up the land. They tried to better their position through wage claims. But you still had very militant strikes in support of these wage claims. And Meath was just a war zone for a long time. And the workers eventually winning a massive pay rise when, after derailments of trains and after massive struggle, the farmers finally got their cattle to Belfast to sell them. And the workers at Belfast refused to unload the trains. And that was it. The strike was over. The farmers gave in. They gave the pay rises. I think what you're talking about altered the flavour of struggle, East and West, but it didn't alter the tempo of struggle.
Okay, Lawrence?
I think the reason why what happened in Tipperary and in the South was down to the fact that the RIC had more or less on the ground disappeared.
Yeah, that's true as well, yeah.
And the people in Ireland controlled the ground, basically, and that was the IRA. Now, I think also back to the idea of why the democratic programme was so accepted. These white wing Sinn Féin, and the reason was the labour union movement was providing a backup or sort of auxiliary resource. You know, they were essential to the movement of arms, safe houses. You know, they were allies. You know what I'm saying? That was a very important ally alliance for the volunteers. And basically, a lot of the volunteers, I think, were very reluctant to put, you know, to get involved in this. They were either sympathetic to these strikes, or just didn't want to get involved in that. And the only other option, since there was no police force, was the army or the paramilitary police, the auxiliary or the battalions. Likewise, they didn't want to sort of stick their necks out for basically something that, it was a very dangerous time. They didn't want to show up.
That's a fair point. I think that's part of the answer as well. The policing of the rural areas diminished non-existent in a lot of areas. Also, that led to a massive change in political alignment of a lot of farmers and agricultural businessmen who had been in favour of the empire, but the empire ceased to exist locally. They're being affected by strikes. So they started to write to the door, the illegal door, would you intervene in our strike? And they were pleasantly surprised to find that the door would intervene. And the door, in fact, produced a pamphlet, The Constructive Work of Dáil Éireann, to impress upon richer farmers that they were being very constructive in their the Dáil courts, nearly always found in favour of the property owner against the property less. So you have a sort of realignment of these figures as a result. But I think that's a good part of the answer as well, that the policing in Dublin would have been a much more intimidating presence than in a lot of the areas.
Kevin?
Yeah, just a question about the Catholic Church and so on during... some of these very radical events. What was the situation? Were they, presumably they were very much on the back foot.
Yeah.
Did they just step back until things settled down with, and then what sort of happened? Was there?
Yeah, that's a good way to put it, because it would be a mistake to say they were against radicalism. That's too crude. The church is quite sophisticated because it's got its roots in obviously in working class areas and rural farming areas. It's not going to simply oppose such big powerful movements, and indeed during the Limerick Soviet, Bishop Killaloe says the church survived communist times in prehistory, medieval times, and it will do so again. So that, you know, we've nothing to fear from communism. So that's the tone when the Limerick Soviet's on. But as soon as the radicalism is dying away, the hierarchy, as opposed to the priests, the hierarchy are very much in favour of law and order, and they jump at the treaty. They give their speeches on a Sunday against the treaty, and their spirit is of they want stability and normality, and for them that's a capitalist normality. So nationalist, yes, but conservative nationalist, and like you said, on the back foot is probably the best way to describe it. They don't want to isolate themselves, but when the opportunity comes and the movement's dying down, then they step forward with an agenda that's absolutely fits with the Free State's agenda. And the Free State, we know that Eamon de Valera did a deal with the church, but we forget that the Free State did the same. In the interest of stability, they introduced various various bits of legislation that favoured the church, especially with regard to publications and so on. Censorship. The church had control of censorship under the Free State.
Sorry, Darren, did you indicate earlier? Sorry.
No,
I apologise.
I can do one more.
Okay.
there's in 1918 with the election at the very end of 1918, by September, William O'Brien and the rest seem to think they're going to go into the election. There's David Fitzgerald, I think, Fitzpatrick. I was talking into this year. I kind of always forget that it's Fitzpatrick. He seems to suggest that kind of they backed out because they wouldn't have a shot, and that it was kind of the nationalism at the time was so overwhelming that some of the workers they asked were suggesting that they would prefer to vote for Sinn Féin, and that Sinn Féin was saying, look, we can do a deal in Dublin where we'll give you maybe 4 seats or whatever. Do you think personally that, or professionally, that it was nationalism that prevented them from going to
election? So the question is, why didn't Labour stand in 1918? I don't think that's the explanation. I don't think that Sinn Féin was so strong that Labour would face humiliation. Absolutely not. Labour would have done quite well. But it posed a problem for them. If they stand, what are they going to stand on? If they stand on the idea of a republic and a break from the empire, then they lose their affiliates in Northern Ireland to the Royal Unionist might and some of the southern affiliates. On the other hand, if they don't stand if they don't promise to go to the door, and if they say that they're going to go to Westminster, they're going to betray the national movement. So they're going to lose support whichever way. And really their only solution would have been to stand on an independent platform of a socialist republic and appeal to the unionist, to the Protestant working class to say, we are not setting up our goal is not a society that would exclude you and marginalise you. But of course, they weren't going to do that. Conley would have, and he did. We know that from his electoral material while he's alive, and Larkin as well. But so they were in a very uncomfortable position. They didn't want to fall out with Sinn Féin. They didn't want to fall out with the Northern affiliates, so they abstained. Now, that's what I think their thinking was. They've done quite well. And the election, the first time they did contest elections, which was the 23, they did really well.
Yeah, I was just wondering, in terms of coming back to Collins again, I suppose when he signed the treaty and came into power, was it his pragmatism? He just had power and he felt he could move against the left at that stage, or why was it so important to move? Like, given that the left would have been, as you said, an important constituent of his support, why did he move so strongly against the left and maybe not the right?
He was obliged to by the terms of the treaty. Collins understood something that I think has been lost, which is that the IRA, although it numbered into the nearly 100,000 on paper, never had more than about 3,000 people with a gun with ammunition in it. And Collins knew that. I mean, he was the main organiser of this. So he knew how precarious the military struggle was. And the repression had taken its toll. He thought the treaty wasn't great, but it was the best that could be got given this military activity. He'd pretty much taken it as far as it could go, and therefore that's a compromise. And he was honest enough to say, right, that's the best we can get. I'm going to go work with that. It's not what I want, but I'm going to work with it. And so, coming under pressure from Britain to implement the terms of the treaty, and also his colleagues on the right of him, he launches an attack, well, on the forecourt, but then his troops also prevent social radicalism. And that's because once he's made that decision, he's in bed with the people who do not want social radicalism. He's in bed with the conservative forces of Irish society. And so I don't think I think he was personally probably very uncomfortable with a lot of this, but he's also, he's kind of honest with himself. I admire him, actually. I'd be totally against the treaty. I'd want to lose the Civil War, don't get me wrong. But at least he's an honest... He's not out to deceive. This is what we can get. I'm sorry, I'm going to implement it. Tough luck on the left. That's the deal. I can't get a better deal. And it's just that his framework is so narrow. It's a military framework. He can't see beyond it. In his terms, there was no other alternative. Now, I think there was an alternative, which is to build on this radicalism, to defeat Britain with the working class movement, and build a 32-county socialist island. That would have been... that could have, I think that that was a potential, and even, yeah, but he's too narrow to think in those kind of terms.
Sorry, I'll just point out, we've only got 5 minutes, and I've already got less than 5 minutes, actually, and so already two people indicated, so I can't take any more new people. Sorry, you've already had your hand up, so you're one of them, and I'll just take the man behind you first.
Cheers. Thanks. Just on that last book, I wonder why the conduct really was, his range of options was so narrow. I swore I wouldn't call it a column slip, but that, you know, George George is dreaded off more on three.
Yeah.
And he did have the years now for too many men had gone to that.
Yeah.
So that, you know.
If you look at it purely as conventional military framework, you don't have a lot of choice. It's naive to think that you could beat Britain and get more on a purely military campaign.
Just my main question was just in relation to the way the people of this country have been portrayed by the government in particular, that were classic peasants, you know, taking the hard medicine, you know, were held up as the poster child, the good boy, taking the austerity and all that shit. I'm just wondering how your book was received at the time. Just a couple of, you know,
96 is when it came out.
Yeah.
Wasn't too well received, actually. I'm in the Socialist Workers Party.
Mm-hmm.
The Socialist Workers Party not entirely comfortable with it. so that's why I speak. I'm delighted to get platforms here because my own party doesn't particularly provide them for you. I don't think they'd say. I don't think they'd say we won't give you one, but they didn't do much to promote it. Why is that? I got persecuted by the Daily Mail back in 1990, and fled Britain and Thatcher, sought her, and came here. And but the British SNP didn't want me doing that, and so they were very cool about me.
Sorry, can't understand.
Yeah, we're out of time. Yeah, anyway, it's kind of getting off the topic, but. but the funny thing is, Secret Diary of a Trot was the headline by the Daily Mail, and they'd broken into a student occupation, the security, and they'd stolen people's belongings to find out who was there. And unfortunately, they'd got my diary, which showed that I'd been a full time organiser for this.
Why didn't they write in the book?
They had to invent reasons. I don't. Their criticisms coming from Chris Bambi were pretty feeble, frankly. What's curious is people who are much more conservative politically, including people who would be on the right, actually quite like the book. Because it's very transparent where I'm coming from. So there's no beating about the bush. You know, you can divorce the fact. You can say, OK, I don't agree with this guy's politics, but this is good material. This is great. I've never read about this before. And then probably dismiss it as I think the book is connected to one's current political practice, but the conservatives who read it and enjoyed it just read it because it was a new angle on the period that they knew so well. But the current edition, you'll see from the back, it's got absolutely glowing praise from Workers' Solidarity and Terry Eagleton and Vinton Lane and Book Tile, and so it found a constituency, it found a home. And I do think radicals who read this book are helped armed, like you say, for today. I mean, we need some group of workers to give an example like this, and I think the whole situation could ignite, because there's so much discontent and bitterness, but there's a feeling you can't do anything. So I'd like to hope that the new edition will add its little tuppence worth to a fight back at some point.
Okay, I'd like to thank Conor for his talk. It's been a very interesting part of Irish history that's often not mentioned in mainstream media. So I'd like to also point out that his book is available for sale if anyone wants to buy it.
Yeah, I'm afraid it's €30, though. That's with my discount included from Court University Press. It's,
that's not what I'm walking past.
Yeah, well, that's
if you exactly mentioned the
paperback version coming out soon.
Yeah.
In the main room.
No. Okay, there's also a film on it. Do you want to mention it?
I did.
This audio was recorded at the 2010 Dublin Anarchist Book Fair. This session is Revolutionary Experiments in Ireland, 1917 to 1923, given by Conor Costick, who was the author of Revolution in Ireland's Popular Militancy, 1917 to 1923. You'll find more about the book fair and more audio at www.wsm.ie.